that after the construction work had been nearly completed and your scheme of decoration fully designed, you should be instructed that the building was to be used on Sundays as a Baptist tabernacle, and that suitable place must be made for a huge organ, a pulpit, and a dipping pool. Then at intervals afterwards you should be advised that it must be so refitted and furnished that parts of it could be used for a courtroom, a jail, a concert hall, hotel, skating rink, for surgical clinics, for a circus, dog show, drill room, ballroom, railway station, and shot tower. That, he wrote, is what is nearly always going on with public parks. Pardon me if I overwhelm you. It is a matter of chronic anger with me. What landscape architecture needed, Olmsted believed, was greater visibility, which in turn would bring greater credibility. The exposition could help, he realized, provided it did rise to the heights envisioned by Ellsworth. He had to weigh this benefit, however, against the near-term costs of signing on. His firm already had a full roster of work. So much, he wrote, that we are always personally under an agitating pressure and cloud of anxiety. And Olmsted himself had grown increasingly susceptible to illness. He was 68 years old and partly lame from a decades-old carriage accident that had left one leg an inch shorter than the other. He was prone to lengthy bouts of depression. His teeth hurt. He had chronic insomnia and facial neuralgia. A mysterious roaring in his ears at times made it difficult for him to attend to conversation. He was still full of creative steam, still constantly on the move, but overnight train journeys invariably laid him low. Even in his own bed, his nights often became sleepless horrors laced with toothache. But Ellsworth's vision was compelling. Olmsted talked it over with his sons and with the newest member of the firm, Henry Sargent Codman. Harry, an intensely talented young landscape architect who quickly had become a trusted advisor and confidant. When Ellsworth returned, Olmsted told him he had changed his mind. He would join the venture. Once back in Chicago, Ellsworth secured formal authority to hire Olmsted and arranged to have him report directly to Burnham. In a letter to Olmsted, Ellsworth wrote, "My position is this. The reputation of America is at stake in this matter, and the reputation of Chicago is also at stake. As an American citizen, you have an equal interest in furthering the success of this great and grand undertaking, and I know from talking with you that on an occasion like this, you grasp the whole situation and will be confined to no narrow limits." Certainly that seemed to be the case when, during later contract negotiations, Olmsted, at Codman's urging, requested a fee of $22,500, about $675,000 today, and got it. On Wednesday, August 6, 1890, 3 weeks after Ellsworth's Brookline visit, the exposition company telegraphed Olmsted, "When can you be here?" Olmsted and Codman arrived 3 days later on Saturday morning and found the city ringing from the news that the final census count had confirmed the earlier, preliminary ranking of Chicago as America's second largest city, even though this final tally also showed that Chicago's lead over Philadelphia was a skimpy one, only 52,324 souls. The good news was a salve for a difficult summer. Earlier, a heat wave had brutalized the city, killing 17 people, including a man named Christ, and neatly eviscerating Chicago's boasts to Congress that the city possessed the charming summer climate, cool and delicious, the Tribune had said, of a vacation resort. And just before the heat wave, a rising young British writer had published a scalding essay on Chicago. "Having seen it," Rudyard Kipling wrote, "I desire never to see it again. It is inhabited by savages." To Burnham, Codman seemed amazingly young, late 20s at the most. To be so young and have the trust of America's greatest landscape architect, Codman must have been very bright indeed. He had gleaming obsidian eyes that looked as if they could punch holes in steel. As for Olmsted, Burnham was struck by the slightness of his frame, which seemed structurally insufficient to support so massive a skull. That head. Bald for most of its surface, trimmed at bottom with a tangled white beard, it resembled an ivory Christmas ball resting on a bed of excelsior. Olmsted looked worn from his travels, but his eyes were large, warm, and bright. He wanted to start work immediately. Here, at last, Burnham saw, was a man who understood the true cost of each lost minute. Burnham, of course, knew of Olmsted's achievements. Central Park in Manhattan, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, the grounds of Cornell and Yale, and scores of other projects. He knew also that before launching the field of landscape architecture, Olmsted had been a writer and editor who had journeyed throughout the antebellum South, exploring the culture and practice of slavery. Olmsted had a reputation for brilliance and tireless devotion to his work, but also for an acerbic candor that emerged most predictably in the presence of men who failed to understand that what he sought to create were not flower beds and ornamental gardens, but expanses of scenery full of mystery, shadow, and sun-stippled ground. Olmsted, for his part, knew that Burnham had been a leading force in driving buildings into the clouds. Burnham was said to be the business genius of his firm, Root the Artist. It was with Burnham that Olmsted felt the greatest kinship. Burnham was decisive, blunt, cordial, and spoke under a level blue gaze that Olmsted found reassuring. In private communication, Olmsted and Codman agreed that Burnham was a man they could work with. The tour began at once, but it was hardly an objective one. Burnham and Root clearly favored one location in particular, Jackson Park on Chicago's south side, due east of Englewood on the lakeshore. As it happens, Olmsted knew this ground. 20 years earlier, at the request of Chicago's South Park commissioners, Olmsted had studied both Jackson Park and, to its west, Washington Park, and the broad boulevard that connected them, called Midway. In the plans he had produced for the commissioners, he envisioned transforming Jackson Park from a desert of sand and stagnant pools into a park unlike any other in the nation, focused on water and boating, with canals, lagoons, and shady coves. Olmsted finished those plans shortly before the Great Fire of 1871. In the rush to rebuild, Chicago never got around to realizing his vision. The park became part of Chicago during the 1889 annexations, but otherwise, Olmsted saw, little had changed. He knew its flaws, its many flaws, but believed that with a lot of deft dredging and sculpting, the park could be transformed into a landscape unlike any that ever seated an exposition. For he recognized that Jackson Park had something no other city in the world could equal. The spreading blue plain of Lake Michigan, as comely a backdrop for a fair as anyone could hope for. On Tuesday, August 12th, just 4 days after he and Codman arrived in Chicago, he filed a report with the exposition directors, who then, to Olmsted's chagrin, made the report public. Olmsted had intended the report for a professional audience, one that would take for granted Jackson Park's fundamental acceptability and value the report as an unflinching guide to the challenges ahead. He was surprised to find the report put to use by opposing cliques as evidence that the fair could not possibly be placed in Jackson Park. The directors asked for a second report. Olmsted delivered it on Monday, August 18th, 6 days after the first. Burnham saw to his delight that Olmsted had given the directors somewhat more than they perhaps had wished to receive. Olmsted was no literary stylist. Sentences wandered through the report like morning glory through the pickets of a fence. But his prose revealed the depth and subtlety of his thinking about how landscape could be modified to produce an effect in the mind. First, he had to set down a few principles and do a little chiding. Rather than squabbling over sights, he lectured, The different factions needed to recognize that for the exposition to succeed, everyone had to work together, no matter what location the directors selected. It is to be desired, let us say, that it should be better understood than it yet seems to be by some of your fellow citizens, that the fair is not to be a Chicago fair. It is a world's fair, and Chicago is to stand before the world as the chosen standard-bearer for the occasion of the United States of America. All Chicago can afford to take nothing less than the very best site that can be found for the fair, regardless of the special local interests of one quarter of the city or another. Every landscape element of the fair, he argued, had to have one supreme object, videlicet, the becomingness. The becomingness of everything that may be seen as a modestly contributive part of a grand whole. The major elements of which whole will be in the towering series of the main exhibition structures. In other words, the grounds, with all it carries, before, between, and behind the buildings, however dressed with turf, or bedecked with flowers, shrubs, or trees, fountains, statues, bric-a-brac, and objects of art, should be one in unity of design with the buildings, should set off the buildings and should be set off in matters of light and shadow and tone by the buildings. Clearly certain sites were endowed more richly than others. More would be gained by associating the exposition with some feature of striking natural beauty than by the most elaborate and costly artificial decorations in the form of gardening features, terraces, fountains, and statues, than it is possible for the mind of man to devise or the hand of man to carry out. What the many factions in the battle for the fair seemed to ignore was that Chicago had but one natural object at all distinctively local, which can be regarded as an object of much grandeur, beauty, or interest. This is the lake. The lake was beautiful and always changing in hue and texture, but it was also, Olmsted argued, a novelty capable of amplifying the drawing power of the exposition. Many visitors from the heart of the country will, until they arrive here, never have seen a broad body of water extending to the horizon, will never have seen a vessel under sail, nor a steamboat of half the tonnage of those to be seen hourly passing in and out of Chicago Harbor, and will never have seen such effects of reflected light or of clouds piling up from the horizon as are to be enjoyed almost every summer's day on the lake margin of the city. Olmsted next considered four specific candidates: a site on the lake shore above the loop, two inland sites, one of which was Garfield Park on the western perimeter of the city, and, of course, Jackson Park. Although Olmsted himself preferred the northernmost site, he insisted Jackson Park could work and produce results of a pleasingly becoming character, such as have not hitherto been aimed at in world's fairs. Olmsted dismissed the inland sites out of hand as being flat and monotonous, and too far from the lake. In critiquing Garfield Park, he again took a moment to express his annoyance at Chicago's inability to select a site, a failure he found all the more exasperating given the elaborate boasts issued by the city's leading men back when they were lobbying Congress for the fair. But considering what has been so strenuously urged upon the attention of the country in regard to the number and excellence of sites which Chicago has to offer, considering what advantages the Centennial Fair in Philadelphia possessed in the neighboring scenery, considering what advantages of the same order would have been possessed by the fair if it had been given a site in the beautiful Rock Creek Valley at Washington, of which the nation is just taking possession for a park, considering what superb views were presented of the Palisades and up the valley of the Hudson on the one hand, and the waters and varied shores of Long Island Sound on the other, from the site offered for the fair by New York. Considering all this, we cannot but fear that the choice of a site in the rear of the city, utterly without natural landscape attraction, would be found a disappointment to the country, and that it would give occasion for not a little ironical reference to the claims of an endless extent of perfect sites made last winter before Congress. The emphasis was Olmsted's. Burnham hoped this second report would at last compel a decision. The delay was maddening, absurd, the hourglass long ago upended. The board seemed unaware that Chicago now risked becoming a national, even global, embarrassment. Weeks passed. By the end of October 1890, the site question remained unresolved. Burnham and Root tended to their fast-growing practice. Contractors had begun erecting two of the firm's newest, tallest Chicago skyscrapers, the Women's Christian Temperance Union Temple and the Masonic Fraternity Temple, at 21 stories, the tallest building in the world. The foundations of both were nearly finished and awaiting the installation of cornerstones. With architecture and construction such a fascination in Chicago, cornerstone ceremonies became extravagant affairs. The temperance celebration took place at the corner of LaSalle and Monroe, beside a 10-ton boulder of dark New Hampshire granite, 17 feet square by 3 feet thick. Here, Burnham and Root joined other dignitaries, including Mrs. Francis E. Willard, president of the union, and Carter Henry Harrison, a former mayor who, with four earlier terms already under his belt, was again running for the office. When Harrison appeared wearing his usual black slouch hat, his pocket quilled with cigars, the crowd roared a welcome, especially the Irish and Union men who saw Harrison as a friend of the city's lower classes. The presence of Burnham, Root, and Harrison beside the temperance stone was more than a bit ironic. As mayor, Harrison had kept a couple of cases of fine bourbon in his office at City Hall. The city's stern Protestant upper class saw him as a civic satyr whose tolerance of prostitution, gambling, and alcohol had allowed the city's vice districts, most notably the Levee, home of the infamous bartender and robber Mickey Finn, to swell to new heights of depravity. Root was a notorious bon vivant, whom Lewis Sullivan once described as a man of the world, of the flesh, and considerably of the devil. And Burnham, in addition to monitoring the global passage of his Madeira, each year bottled 400 quarts of lesser stuff sent to him by a friend, and personally selected the wines for the cellar of the Union League Club. With great ceremony, Burnham handed a silver-plated trowel to Mrs. T.B. Carse, president of the Temple Building Association, whose smile suggested she knew nothing of these monstrous habits, or at least was willing for the moment to ignore them. She scooped up a mound of mortar previously laid for purposes of the ceremony, then reapplied it and tapped it back into place. Prompting a witness to observe, she patted the mortar as a man sometimes pats the head of a curly-haired boy. She passed the trowel to the fearsome Mrs. Willard, who stopped the mortar more heartily and got some of it on her gown. Root, according to a witness, leaned toward friends and suggested sotto voce that they all cut away for cocktails. Nearby at the distribution warehouse of the Chicago Inter-Ocean, a widely read and respected newspaper, a young Irish immigrant and staunch supporter of Carter Harrison completed his workday. His name was Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast. He ran a squad of obstreperous newsboys whom he loathed and who loathed him in return, as was clear by their taunts and practical jokes. That Prendergast might one day shape the destiny of the world's Columbian Exposition would have seemed ridiculous to these boys, for Prendergast, to them, was about as hapless and sorry a human being as they could imagine. He was 22 years old, born in Ireland in 1868. His family emigrated to the United States in 1871, and in August that year moved to Chicago, just in time to experience the Great Fire. He was always, as his mother said, a shy and retiring kind of a boy. He got his grade school education at Chicago's De La Salle Institute. Brother Adjutor, one of his teachers, said, While in school, he was a remarkable boy in this way, that he was very quiet and took no part in the play of the other students at noontime. He would generally stand around. From the appearance of the boy, I would be led to think that he was not well, that he was sick. Prendergast's father got him a job delivering telegrams for Western Union, which the boy held for a year and a half. When Prendergast was 13, his father died, and he lost his only friend. For a time, his withdrawal from the world seemed complete. He awakened slowly. He began reading books about law and politics and to attend meetings of the Single Tax Club, which embraced Henry George's belief that private landowners should pay a tax, essentially rent, to reflect the underlying truth that land belonged to everyone. At these meetings, Prendergast insisted on taking part in every conversation and once had to be carried from the room. To his mother, he seemed to be a different man, well-read, animated, involved. She said he got smart all of a sudden. In fact, his madness had become more profound. When he was not working, he wrote postcards, scores of them, perhaps hundreds, to the most powerful men in the city, in a voice that presumed he was their equal in social stature. He wrote to his beloved Harrison and to assorted other politicians, including the governor of Illinois. It's possible even Burnham received a card, given his new prominence. That Prendergast was a troubled young man was clear. That he might be dangerous seemed impossible. To anyone who met him, he appeared to be just another poor soul crushed by the din and filth of Chicago. But Prendergast had grand hopes for the future, all of which rested on one man, Carter Henry Harrison. He threw himself eagerly into Harrison's campaign, albeit without Harrison's knowledge, sending postcards by the dozens and telling anyone who would listen that Harrison, staunch friend of the Irish and the working man, was the best candidate for the job. He believed that when Harrison at last won his fifth two-year term, ideally in the upcoming April 1891 election, but perhaps not until the next in 1893, he would reward Prendergast with a job. That was how Chicago politics worked. He had no doubt that Harrison would come through and rescue him from the frozen mornings and venomous newsboys that for the moment defined his life. Among the most progressive alienists, this kind of unfounded belief was known as a delusion, associated with a newly identified disorder called paranoia. Happily, most delusions were harmless. On October 25, 1890, the site for the fair still unchosen, worrisome news arrived from Europe, the first hint of forces gathering that could do infinitely more damage to the fair than the director's stalemate. The Chicago Tribune reported that increasing turbulence in global markets had raised concerns in London that a recession, even a full-blown panic, could be in the offing. Immediately, these concerns began buffeting Wall Street. Railroad stocks tumbled. The value of Western Union's shares fell by 5%. The next Saturday, news of a truly stunning failure began stuttering through the submarine cable that linked Britain and America. In Chicago, before the news arrived, brokers spent a good deal of time discussing the morning's strange weather. An unusually murky pall hung over the city. Brokers joked how the gloom might be the signal that a day of judgment was at hand. The chuckling faded with the first telegrams from London. Baring Brothers and Company, the powerful London investment house, was on the verge of closure. The news, a Tribune writer observed, was almost incredible. The Bank of England and a syndicate of financiers were racing to raise a fund to guarantee Baring's financial obligations. The wild rush that followed to sell stocks was something terrible. It was a veritable panic for an hour. For Burnham and the exposition directors, this wave of financial damage was troubling. If indeed it marked the start of a true and deep financial panic, the timing was abysmal. In order for Chicago to live up to its boasts about surpassing the Paris Exposition in both size and attendance, the city would have to spend far more heavily than the French and capture a lot more visitors. Yet the Paris show had drawn more people than any other peaceful event in history. In the best of times, winning an audience of that scale would be a challenge. In the worst, impossible, especially since Chicago's interior location guaranteed that most visitors would have to buy an overnight train ticket. The railroads had made it known early and forcefully that they had no plans to discount their Chicago fares just for the exposition. Other corporate failures occurred both in Europe and the United States, but their true meaning remained for the moment unclear. In retrospect, a good thing. In the midst of this intensifying financial turbulence, on October 30th, the Exposition Board appointed Burnham Chief of Construction, with a salary equivalent to $360,000. Burnham in turn made Root the fair's supervising architect, and Olmsted its supervising landscape architect. Burnham now possessed formal authority to begin building a fair, but still had no place to put it. Don't be afraid. As Englewood gained population, Holmes's sales of tonics and lotions increased. By the end of 1886, the pharmacy was running smoothly and profitably. His thoughts turned now to a woman he had met earlier in the year during his brief stay in Minneapolis, Myrta Z. Belknap. She was young and blonde, with blue eyes and a lush figure, but what elevated her above mere beauty was the aura of vulnerability and need that surrounded her. She became an immediate obsession, her image and need locked in his brain. He traveled to Minneapolis, ostensibly on business. He had no doubt he would succeed. It amused him that women as a class were so wonderfully vulnerable, as if they believed the codes of conduct that applied in their safe little hometowns, like Alva, Clinton, and Percy, might actually still apply once they had set out on their own and left their dusty, kerosene-scented parlors behind. The city toughened them quickly, however. Best to catch them at the start of their ascent toward freedom, in transit from small places when they were anonymous, lost, their presence recorded nowhere. Every day he saw them, stepping from trains and grip cars and hansom cabs, inevitably frowning at some piece of paper that was supposed to tell them where they belonged. The city's madams understood this, and were known to meet inbound trains with promises of warmth and friendship, saving the important news for later. Holmes adored Chicago, adored in particular how the smoke and din could envelop a woman and leave no hint that she ever had existed, save perhaps a blade-thin track of perfume amid the stench of dung, anthracite, and putrefaction. To Myrta, Holmes seemed to have stepped from a world far more exciting than her own. She lived with her parents and clerked in a music store. Minneapolis was small, somnolent, and full of Swedish and Norwegian farmers as charming as cornstalks. Holmes was handsome, warm, and obviously wealthy, and he lived in Chicago, the most feared and magnetic of cities. Even during their first meeting, he touched her. His eyes deposited a bright blue hope. When he left the store that first day, as motes of dust filled the space he left behind, her own life seemed drab beyond endurance. A clock ticked. Something had to change. When his first letter arrived, asking sweetly if he might court her, she felt as if a coarse blanket had been lifted from her life. Every few weeks he returned to Minneapolis. He told her about Chicago. He described its skyscrapers and explained how each year the buildings grew taller and taller. He told her pleasantly shocking stories of the stockyards, how the hogs climbed the bridge of size to an elevated platform, where chains were attached to their hind legs, and they were swept away, shrieking, along an overhead track down into the bloody core of the slaughterhouse. And romantic stories, how Potter Palmer had been so in love with his wife Bertha that he had given her a luxurious hotel, the Palmer House, as a wedding present. There were rules about courtship. Although no one set them down on paper, every young woman knew them and knew instantly when they were being broken. Holmes broke them all, and with such forthright lack of shame that it became clear to Murta that the rules must be different in Chicago. At first it frightened her, but she found quickly that she liked the heat and risk. When Holmes asked her to be his wife, she accepted immediately. They married on January 28, 1887. Holmes neglected to tell Murta that he already had a wife, Clara Lovering, the original Mrs. Herman Webster Mudgett. 2 weeks after marrying Murta, he filed a petition in the Supreme Court of Cook County, Illinois, to divorce Lovering. This was no fine-spirited gesture to clear the record. He charged Lovering with infidelity, a ruinous accusation. He allowed the petition to lapse, however, and eventually the court dismissed it for failure to prosecute. In Chicago, Murta saw at once that the stories Holmes had told of the city only barely captured its glamour and dangerous energy. It was like a cauldron of steaming iron, trains everywhere, jarring, but also a reminder that life had opened to her at last. In Minneapolis, there had been only silence and the inevitable clumsy petitions of potato-fingered men looking for someone, anyone, to share the agony of their days. That Holmes lived in Englewood, not the heart of Chicago, was at first a disappointment, but here, too, there was a vibrancy far beyond what she had experienced at home. She and Holmes settled into the second-floor apartment previously occupied by Mrs. Holton. By the spring of 1888, Murta was pregnant. At first, she helped run the drugstore. She liked working with her husband and often watched him when he was engaged with a customer. She savored his looks and blue calm and craved the moments when, in the course of routine tasks, their bodies would touch. She admired, too, the charm with which he managed each transaction, and how he won the business even of elderly customers loyal to the absent Mrs. Holton. And she smiled, at least initially, as each in a seemingly endless train of young women entered the store, insisting that only direct consultation with Dr. Holmes himself would suffice. Murta came to see that underneath her husband's warm and charming exterior, there flowed a deep current of ambition. He seemed a druggist in name only. He more closely fit the prevailing ideal of the self-made man who, through hard work and invention, pulled himself, rung by rung, into the upper strata of society. "Ambition has been the curse of my husband's life," Murta said later. "He wanted to attain a position where he would be honored and respected. He wanted wealth." She insisted, however, that his ambition never impaired his character and never distracted him from his role as husband and eventually father. Holmes, she swore, had a gentle heart. He adored children and animals. He was a lover of pets and always had a dog or cat, and usually a horse, and he would play with them by the hour, teaching them little tricks or romping with them. He neither drank nor smoked and did not gamble. He was affectionate and impossible to ruffle. "In his home life, I do not think there was ever a better man than my husband," Murta said. "He never spoke an unkind word to me or our little girl or my mother. He was never vexed or irritable, but was always happy and free from care." Yet, from the start, tension suffused their marriage. Holmes expressed no hostility. The heat came from Myrta, who quickly tired of all those young female customers and the way Holmes would smile at them and touch them and channel his blue gaze into their eyes. At first, she had found it appealing. Then it made her uneasy. Finally, it made her jealous and watchful. Her increasing possessiveness did not anger Holmes. Rather, he came to see her as an obstacle, just as a sea captain might view an iceberg, something to monitor and avoid. Business was so good, he told Myrta, that he needed her help managing the store's books. She found herself spending more and more time in an office upstairs, writing correspondence and preparing invoices for the drugstore. She wrote to her parents of her sorrow. In the summer of 1888, her parents moved to Wilmette, Illinois, where they occupied a pretty two-story house on John Street opposite a church. Lonely, sad, and pregnant, Myrta joined them at the house and there bore a daughter, Lucy. Suddenly, Holmes began acting like a dutiful husband. Myrta's parents were cool at first, but he courted their approval with moist-eyed declarations of regret and displays of adoration for his wife and child. He succeeded. His presence, Myrta said, was like oil on troubled waters, as Mother often said to him. He was so kind, so gentle and thoughtful, that we forgot our cares and worries. He begged their forbearance for his lengthy absences from the Wilmette house. There was so much to do in Chicago. From the way he dressed and the money he gave Myrta, he certainly seemed like a man on the rise, and this perception went a long way to ease the concerns of Myrta's parents. They and Myrta settled into a life marked by increasingly widespread visits from Dr. Holmes, but when he did appear, he brought warmth and gifts and entombed little Lucy in his arms. It is said that babies are better judges of people than grown-up persons, Myrta said, and I never saw a baby that would not go to Mr. Holmes and stay with him contentedly. They would go to him when they wouldn't come to me. He was remarkably fond of children. Often when we were traveling and there happened to be a baby in the car, he would say, "Go and see if they won't lend you that baby a little while." And when I brought it to him, he would play with it, forgetting everything else, until its mother called for it or I could see that she wanted it. He has often taken babies that were crying from their mothers, and it would hardly be any time until he had them sound asleep or playing as happily as little ones can. With Englewood booming, Holmes saw an opportunity. Ever since acquiring Holton's drugstore, he had been interested in the undeveloped land across the street. After a few inquiries, he learned that it was owned by a woman in New York. In the summer of 1888, he bought the land and, thinking ahead, registered the deed under a false name, H.S. Campbell. Soon afterward, he began jotting notes and sketching features for a building he planned to erect on the lot. He did not consult an architect, although a fine one, a Scotsman named A.A. Fraser, had an office in the building that housed Holton's store. To hire an architect would have meant revealing the true character of the structure that suddenly had lodged itself in his imagination. The building's broad design and its function had come to him all at once, like a blueprint pulled from a drawer. He wanted retail shops on the first floor to generate income and allow him to employ as many women as possible. Apartments would fill the second and third. His personal flat and a large office would occupy the second floor corner overlooking the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. These were the basics. It was the details of the building that gave him the most pleasure. He sketched a wooden chute that would descend from a secret location on the second floor all the way to the basement. He planned to coat the chute with axle grease. He envisioned a room next to his office fitted with a large walk-in vault with airtight seams and asbestos-coated iron walls. A gas jet embedded in one wall would be controlled from his closet, as would other gas jets installed in apartments throughout the building. There would be a large basement with hidden chambers and a sub-basement for the permanent storage of sensitive material. As Holmes dreamed and sketched, the features of his building became more elaborate and satisfying. Yet this was only the dream phase. He could hardly imagine the pleasure that would fill his days when the building was done and flesh-and-blood women moved among its features. As always, the thought aroused him. Constructing the building, he knew, would be no small challenge. He devised a strategy that he believed would not only allay suspicions, but also reduce the costs of construction. He placed newspaper advertisements for carpenters and laborers, and soon workers with teams of horses began excavating the land. The resulting hole evoked a giant grave and exuded the same musty chill, but this was not unwelcome, for it provided workers with relief from the intensifying summer heat. The men had difficulty with the soil. The top few feet were easy to manage, but below this the earth became sandy and wet. The sides of the pit had to be shored with timber. The walls bled water. A later report by a Chicago building inspector noted, "There is an uneven settlement of foundations, in some places as much as 4 inches in a span of 20 feet." Bricklayers set the foundation and laid the exterior walls, while carpenters erected the interior frame. The street resonated with the wheeze of handsaws. Holmes cast himself as a demanding contractor. As workers came to him for their wages, he berated them for doing shoddy work and refused to pay them, even if the work was perfect. They quit, or he fired them. He recruited others to replace them and treated these workers the same way. Construction proceeded slowly, but at a fraction of the proper cost. The high rate of turnover had the corollary benefit of keeping to a minimum the number of individuals who understood the building's secrets. A worker might be ordered to perform a certain task, for example, to install the gas nozzle inside the big walk-in vault, but in the narrow context within which the worker functioned, the assignment could seem reasonable, or at worst, merely eccentric. Even so, a bricklayer named George Bowman found the experience of working for Holmes somewhat chilling. "I don't know what to make of Holmes," Bowman said. "I hadn't been working for him but 2 days before he came around and asked me if I didn't think it pretty hard work, this bricklaying. He asked me if I wouldn't like to make money easier than that, and of course I told him yes. A few days after, he came over to me and, pointing down to the basement, said, 'You see that man down there? Well, that's my brother-in-law, and he has got no love for me, neither have I for him. Now, it would be the easiest matter for you to drop a stone on that fellow's head while you're at work, and I'll give you $50 if you do.'" What made the incident particularly frightening was Holmes's manner as he made the offer. "About the same manner one would expect from a friend who was asking you the most trivial question," Bowman said. Whether Holmes truly meant for Bowman to kill the man cannot be known. It would have been wholly within character for Holmes to have first persuaded the brother-in-law to take out a life insurance policy with Holmes as beneficiary. It was possible, too, that Holmes was merely testing Bowman to determine how useful he might be in the future. If so, it was a test that Bowman failed. "I was so badly scared I didn't know what to say or do," Bowman said. "But I didn't drop the stone, and got out of the place soon after." 3 men did meet Holmes's standard of trustworthiness. Each worked for him throughout the period of construction, and continued to associate with him after the building was completed. One was Charles Chappell, a machinist who lived near Cook County Hospital. He first worked for Holmes as a common laborer, but soon proved to possess a talent that Holmes found particularly valuable. Another was Patrick Quinlan, who lived at 47th and Morgan in Englewood until he moved into Holmes's building as its caretaker. He was a small, twitchy man in his late 30s, with light curly hair and a sandy mustache. The third and most important was Benjamin Pitizel, a carpenter, who joined Holmes in November 1889. He replaced a worker named Robert Latimer, who had quit to take over as gatekeeper at the rail intersection in front of Holmes's drugstore. At first, Latimer said, Pitizel took care of the horses involved in the construction of Holmes's building, but later became his all-around assistant. Holmes and Pitizel seemed to have a close relationship, close enough at least for Holmes to do Pitizel a costly favor. Pitizel was arrested in Indiana for attempting to pass forged checks. Holmes posted bail and forfeited the amount when Pitizel, as planned, failed to return for trial. Pitizel had smooth features and a sharp, well-defined chin. He might have been handsome if not for a certain hungry gauntness and the way the lids of his eyes cloaked the top of each iris. In a general way, Holmes said, I should describe him a man nearly 6 feet high, at least 5 feet 10 inches, always thin in flesh and weighing from 145 to 155 pounds, having very black and somewhat coarse hair, very thick, with no tendency to baldness. His mustache was a much lighter color and I think of a red tinge, though I have seen him have it colored black at times, which gave him quite a different appearance. Pitizel was plagued with various maladies, sore knees from the installation of one too many floors, a wart on his neck that kept him from wearing a stiff collar, and teeth so painful that at one point he had to suspend his work for Holmes. Despite being a chronic alcoholic, he was, in the appraisal of one doctor, a man of fine physique. Pitizel was married to Carrie Canning of Galva, Illinois, and the father of a fast-increasing number of children. Photographs of the children show a sweet, if sober, bunch, who seem ready in a moment's notice to swing into action with brooms and dishcloths. The couple's first daughter, Desi, had been born out of wedlock, an event entirely within the realm of what Pitizel's parents had come to expect of their son. In a last plea for Pitizel to take a more righteous path, his father wrote, Come with me, and I will do thee good, is the Savior's command. Will you go? I will take that wicked nature out of you, and I will wash from you all stains, and I will be a father to you, and you shall be a son and an heir. The pain in his father's words was palpable. I love you, he wrote, although you have gone far astray. Alice, the second child, was born soon after the marriage. Another daughter and three sons followed, although one boy died of diphtheria shortly after birth. Three of the children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, would become so well known throughout America that headline writers would refer to them by their first names alone, confident that even the most remote reader understood exactly who they were. Pitizel, too, would achieve a certain fame because of Holmes. Pitizel was his tool, a district attorney said, his creature. Construction of Holmes's building occurred in ragged stages and more or less halted each winter at the close of what workers called the building season. Although Holmes had read how architects in the loop were using techniques that allowed construction year-round. Eventually, much would be made of the fact that Holmes had erected his building during the same period in which Jack the Ripper, thousands of miles away, began his killings. The first of Jack's murders occurred August 31st, 1888, the second a week later. Both victims were prostitutes, both had their throats cut, but there was more. After the second killing, a report in the British medical journal, The Lancet, concluded, obviously the work was that of an expert, or one at least who had such knowledge of anatomical or pathological examinations as to be enabled to secure the pelvic organs with one sweep of the knife. Police had no suspects and no real clues, but a London news service did receive a letter from someone claiming to be the killer. The writer signed it Jack the Ripper. Two of London's top detectives believed the letter to be a fake, written by a newspaper reporter to help keep the story alive. But the letter had an unintended effect. It compelled the real Whitechapel murderer to send off a note of his own. First, however, he took two more victims in a single night. Just as before, these women were prostitutes. He cut the throat of the first, but apparently was interrupted before he could pursue his other explorations. Moments later, he got the opportunity when he encountered Catherine Eddowes. This time he removed and kept a kidney. 2 weeks later, he mailed a package to one George Lusk, head of a vigilante group formed to hunt him down. The killer enclosed a letter and a portion of Eddowes' kidney. He claimed to have eaten the rest. He did not call himself Jack, but ended the letter with a taunt. "Catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk." The Ripper struck for the last time on the night of November 9, 1888. He met a prostitute named Mary Kelly and allowed her to bring him back to her rooms, where he slashed her throat in a Van Gogh stroke that nearly removed her head from her spine. This time, secure within walls, he made a more leisurely excursion into flesh and viscera. Over the next few hours, he carved off her breasts and placed these on a table along with her nose. He slashed her from throat to pubis, skinned her thighs, removed her internal organs, and arranged them in a pile between her feet. He cut off a hand, which he then thrust into her bisected abdomen. Kelly had been 3 months pregnant at the time. Abruptly, the murders stopped, as if that tryst with Mary Kelly had sated the killer's need at last. 5 confirmed victims, only 5, and Jack the Ripper became the embodiment forever of pure evil. Every Chicago resident who could read devoured these reports from abroad, but none with quite so much intensity as Dr. H. H. Holmes. On June 29, 1889, when Holmes's building was half completed, Chicago annexed Englewood and soon afterward established a new police precinct, the 10th 2nd Division, at 63rd and Wentworth, 7 blocks from Holmes's pharmacy. Soon, patrolmen under the command of Captain Horace Elliott began making regular walks past the store, where, in accord with custom, they stopped to chat with the young and personable owner. Periodically, the officers ambled across the street to watch construction of the new building. Englewood already had a number of substantial structures, including the YMCA, Normal School, and lavish Timmerman Opera House, now nearing completion at 63rd and Stewart. But the village still had a lot of open terrain, and any building destined to occupy an entire block was a topic of conversation. Construction took another year, with the usual hiatus for winter. By May 1890, the building was largely done. The second floor had 6 corridors, 35 rooms, and 51 doors. The third, another 36 rooms. The building's first floor had space for 5 retail stores, the best of which was a large and inviting corner shop on the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. 1 month after moving into his building, Holmes sold the former Holton drugstore and assured the buyer that he would face little competition. To the buyer's chagrin, Holmes promptly opened a new drugstore just across the street in his own corner shop. Holmes installed a variety of other businesses in his remaining first-floor stores, including a barber shop and restaurant. City directories also listed at Holmes's address the office of a doctor named Henry D. Mann, possibly a Holmes alias, and the headquarters of the Warner Glass Bending Company, a company Holmes formed ostensibly to enter the booming new business of making and shaping the large sheets of plate glass suddenly in so much demand. Holmes equipped his shops with furniture and fixtures that he bought on credit. He had no intention of paying his debts, and was confident he could evade prosecution through guile and charm. When creditors came by demanding to see the owner of the building, Holmes referred them happily to the fictive H.S. Campbell. "He was the smoothest man I ever saw," said C. E. Davis, whom Holmes had hired to manage the drugstore's jewelry counter. "Creditors," Davis said, "would come here raging and calling him all the names imaginable, and he would smile and talk to them and set up the cigars and drinks and send them away seemingly his friends for life. I never saw him angry. You couldn't have trouble with him if you tried." Davis gestured toward the store. "If all the writs of mechanics' lien that have been levied on this structure were pasted on these three walls, the block would look like a mammoth circus billboard. But I never heard of a lien being collected. Holmes used to tell me he had a lawyer paid to keep him out of trouble, but it always seemed to me that it was the courteous, audacious rascality of the fellow that pulled him through. One day he bought some furniture for his restaurant and moved it in, and that very evening the dealer came around to collect his bill or remove his goods. Holmes set up the drinks, took him to supper, bought him a cigar, and sent the man off laughing at a joke, with a promise to call the next week for his money. In 30 minutes after he took his car, Holmes had wagons in front loading up that furniture, and the dealer never got a cent. Holmes didn't go to jail either. He was the only man in the United States that could do what he did." Holmes had the money to pay his debts. Davis estimated that Holmes made $200,000 through his drugstore and other business ventures, most of which were fraudulent. Holmes attempted, for example, to sell investors a machine that turned water into natural gas. He secretly connected his prototype to city gas lines. He was always charming and cordial, but there were times when even these traits failed to put his business associates at ease. A druggist named Erickson recalled how Holmes used to come into his store to buy chloroform, a potent but unpredictable anesthetic in use since the Civil War. "I sometimes sold him the drug 9 or 10 times a week, and each time it was in large quantities. I asked him what he used it for on several occasions, but he gave me very unsatisfactory answers. At last I refused to let him have any more unless he told me, as I pretended that I was afraid that he was not using it for any proper purpose." Holmes told Erickson he was using the chloroform for scientific experiments. Later, when Holmes returned for more chloroform, Erickson asked him how his experiments were coming. Holmes gave him a blank look and said he was not conducting any experiments. "I could never make him out," Erickson said. A woman named Strowers occasionally did Holmes's laundry. One day he offered to pay her $6,000 if she would acquire a $10,000 life insurance policy and name him beneficiary. When she asked why he would do such a thing, he explained that upon her death he'd make a profit of $4,000, but in the meantime she'd be able to spend her $6,000 in whatever manner she chose. To Mrs. Strowers this was a fortune, and all she had to do was sign a few documents. Holmes assured her it was all perfectly legal. She was healthy and expected to live a good long while. She was on the verge of accepting the offer when Holmes said to her, softly, "Don't be afraid of me," which terrified her. In November 1890, Holmes learned along with the rest of Chicago that the directors of the World's Columbian Exposition had at last reached a decision as to where to build the fair. To his delight, he read that the main site was to be Jackson Park, due east of his building at the lake end of 63rd, with exhibits also in downtown Chicago and Washington Park, and along the full length of Midway Boulevard. Holmes knew the parks from his bicycle journeys. Like most Americans, he had become caught up in the bicycle craze ignited by the advent of the safety bicycle, with its same-sized wheels and chain and sprocket drive. Unlike most Americans, however, Holmes sought also to capitalize on the craze by buying bicycles on credit, then reselling them without ever paying off the initial purchase. He himself wrote a Pope. The exposition company's decision raised a groundswell of greed throughout Chicago's South Side. An advertisement in the Tribune offered a 6-room house for sale at 41st and Ellis, a mile or so north of Jackson Park, and boasted that during the fair the new owner could expect to let 4 of the 6 rooms for nearly $1,000 a month, or about $30,000 in